This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, The Balance of Power: Sexism and Sexual Harassment in the Publishing Industry.
So, this is a bit of a harder topic to discuss.
Yeah, it's quite a confronting topic, isn't it? There's no way to tiptoe around this one.
No, we've kind of thrown ourselves into the deep end. But with the recent news coming out on this subject, we felt that it was just something that had to be addressed.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, I think actually, Jules, that you've read more on this subject than I have.
Yeah, see, all of this has happened in the wake of Me Too.
Yeah.
And, okay, I won't go into that too much. If you've missed that somehow, then you must have been living under a rock, basically, because the news has been full of it. Sexual harassment is across the board in pretty much every industry, but in some industries it's particularly pernicious, and this is to do with the way the world is set up, basically, at the moment. So that certain hands hold the concentration of power, and it can be quite difficult to... Basically, it's more likely for women, particularly young women who haven't made it yet, to find themselves in an awkward position. This has been going on in the children's publishing industry, and it's only now really coming out.
Yeah, I don't know why. I mean, obviously, sexual harassment in any place is abhorrent.
Yeah.
But I think it's just shocking, in a way, when you think of it, when you tie it in with children. Probably because we have this premise, or this understanding that there should be an innocence involved there. And we kind of forget that just because it's children's fiction doesn't mean that it's not full of adults who are big part of, who are running a business. And where there are adults and where there is a business, there is corruption on some level. And you are going to get some people who think that that kind of behavior is acceptable. And you're going to get people who get a little bit drunk and a little bit confident on the power they have and begin to think that they're untouchable.
Yeah, and that certainly has been a thing, particularly with all the Harvey Weinstein cases recently. Yeah. And, you know, it's come out from various other actors, high-profile producers and directors and things. What gets me about that a little bit is that, for one thing, in the acting industry, a lot more money tends to be thrown at it. You know, it's stratospherically bigger in a lot of ways. Yeah. And... power corrupts, but power really attracts the corruptible in a lot of ways. So you need to bear that in mind. So where the money is, the power is. And where the power is, you're going to find some real lowlifes.
Yeah.
And that's the way of the world. That's not a case of, oh, well, you know, men will be attracted to that. It's easier for men to get into those positions because the world is set up for men. And that's a simple fact. That's not me throwing beanie babies. That's just a case of, you know, the world is set up that way at the moment. And people are trying to change that. But you do not expect to find that in publishing. Publishing can be quite lucrative in certain areas, but generally, it's not full of rock stars, is it? So you wouldn't expect people to be coming on like Kiss or Slash or somebody, kicking over televisions and having like this entourage of, you know, barely legal teens following them. And that's a bit of an overstatement. But the fact that you're getting some of this thing, I mean, this is in the wake of Anne Urso's She Anne Urso is a journalist who did some investigating and a survey into sexual harassment in the publishing industry, particularly with children's authors.
Yeah.
And she wrote a blog piece about it. And it was, you know, it was informed by fact, but she didn't put a lot of opinion on it. It was a case of read it and decide for yourself. And having read it, it's appalling. And then obviously there was the list of the school libraries list, wasn't there, where people were coming forward and saying, you know, I've had this experience with this author, and so on and so forth, all the way down. And then more and more people are coming out and saying things. So,
yeah,
people are being named.
Yeah. And what's happened is that actually, you know, there's a bit of backlash to this of people saying, oh, they're just trying to tear these people's names down and things like that. Or, you know, this is just, people are just coming in for their 5 minutes of fame. You know, it is possible that there might be lies among that. But I think that the overwhelming evidence and the overwhelming statements from people does address that there is clearly an issue.
Definitely.
And it's sort of coming to the light of day. There have been accounts, particularly, and sort of moving away just from the publishing, looking at authors in general, because authors, you know, we're talking about rock stars and stuff like that. You can definitely get kind of rock star authors nowadays.
Oh, absolutely you can. And, you know, you forget as an author how much power you have. Even if you're sort of at the lower end of the scale and you haven't even really made it to be a mid-lister yet, you still have a lot more power as an influencer than you think you have.
Yeah.
And it's something that I trip myself up with occasionally.
But I mean, it's also, you know, the fact that people also perceive the kind of power that authors have, and people sort of hold them up to a certain light, often actually over-exaggerating the power they have. So, for instance, you know, you'll have authors who are having films made of their books.
Yeah.
And who don't actually have anything to do with the films themselves, and, you know, who aren't the ones who are choosing the actors. And an actor is chosen who fans don't feel is appropriate for the part, and they lash out at the author.
Yeah, I've seen that happen for various authors. The fact of the matter is, if there are any writers listening to this, if you happen to sign a contract with a big publisher, or mm-hmm. you happen to, if someone comes and options your book for a film, or and then goes on to actually produce the film and make the film, there is a less than a 0.01% chance that you're going to get any say whatsoever in who acts in that film.
Yeah.
You know, just to be realistic. So, I think J.K. Rowling only got the slightest say at all about Fantastic Beasts. And if you think of how successful she was before that, she still didn't get a say on who was in any of the Harry Potter films. So, you know, that's how successful you would actually need to be for your input to be taken into account.
Yeah. Well, we're not going to go into J.K. Rowling, but in general, you know, I've seen things with John Green as well and a number of other authors where people really do hold them accountable for everything. And people also think that they have this absolute power, and they're treated in a godly way, in the way that we popularize celebrities, and writers can now be celebrities. In an even more massive way, probably because of social media, and also because the industry has changed, whereby it's not just the book which is sold to people, but the author themselves are sold to people. And we have a lot more book touring, and we have a lot more opportunities to meet these authors. And especially for sort of young readers, within the children's book industry, this is a person who's created a world that they enjoy. You know, this is a person for whom they admire. This is a person where the only contact they have with this amazing superstar is through a very, very limited view that is put through the media. Because, of course, they need to be sold. So we don't see their imperfections. Or if we see their imperfections, they're spun in a way which is endearing, or in a way that says, oh, they're humble. You know, ultimately, it turns into a positive. Because when we show ourselves on social media, we are, you know, we're not going to be the worst aspect of ourselves. We want people to like us. We want people to buy our books. So you get this. You see these people who are perfection personified, really, in every aspect of life. They've created something you love. As far as, you know, you have no idea how much money they make. But they're dressed nicely, okay? That they've got a huge crowd of people listening to them talk attentively. You know what I mean? It creates this image of power, which actually then gives the author or gives whoever the speaker is even more power. It gives them more respect. And that power starts to get dangerous, especially when you then have young authors coming into the industry and they perceive these amazing people who are their goal. They are the ones that we're striving toward. We want to be that person who sells a book deal for like 7 digits, or you know what I mean? We want to be that person who others recognize in the street. And we also know that we can't then make an enemy of these people. And so then to have situations whereby these very popular authors take advantage of these younger authors is really scary, because we're not socially equipped, that we don't have the industry on our side. You know, we're just not equipped to be able to deal with those situations.
No, I think it's worth bearing in mind here, obviously, most authors tend to be introverts.
Yeah.
So they either see this power and think, oh God, that's scary, and kind of run away screaming, you know, internally, because they wouldn't make a lot of noise outside. Or, you know, what puts the final nail in the coffin with certain authors, if we're talking specifically authors, it's some of them are quite charismatic people as well, which is exactly the sort of author that book fairs and, you know, writers' events and things, exactly the sort of person they want to come in, someone successful and charismatic who sells the dream that it could be you too.
Yeah.
And generally, those are the people, it would seem, most likely on the list who are actually kind of, you know, they've fallen for their own press and they're kind of taking advantage of it. I think it's worth, you know, we can't really talk around this very much more. Let's just go straight into it. The big example of that list is Jay Asher of 13 Reasons Why.
Yeah.
I'm inclined to believe X many number of people who've come forward and said they've had experiences of sexual harassment from him. And the fact that he was warned by the, you know, the literary event coordinators once, and yet they still invited him back. So, you know, this isn't an unheard of thing. This is an open secret. What's really disturbing about that? I don't know if you've ever read 13 Reasons Why.
No, I haven't, no.
Did you see the Netflix series?
I stayed away from it because it looked a bit too hard-hitting for me.
It was... Hard-hitting's not quite the right word, I think, for it. I've heard somebody say, look, when this book was published back in, I think it was 2006 or something.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been before that. But anyway, it was a case of there weren't very many books about teen suicide there that just repeated the facts kind of thing.
Yeah.
I didn't read it until much later. And I didn't like the book because I didn't think it was very well written, for one thing. And also I hated the characters, really kind of hated them actively.
Yeah.
But it did contain a lot of points that I thought were interesting, and they were interesting openers for discussion. The Netflix series then takes certain of those points and explores them further.
Yeah.
Now, the thing that really makes the book kind of worth looking at is its portrayal of rape culture. And what's really disturbing is that you've got an author out there who has made his mark and his name and his money out of portraying rape culture and selling that whole, I understand this. This is what it's like to be a teenager, particularly to young female teens and young 20-year-olds as well.
Mm-hmm.
Young 20-year-olds, if you're 20, you're young anyway. Well, you are, aren't you?
Shut up.
But I don't know, what kind of cognitive dissonance do you have to develop for yourself? What kind of mental gymnastics do you have to jump through in order to do that? And then divorce yourself from what you've written and what you apparently stand for, and then prey on those up-and-coming women that you have actually probably inspired a lot of at author events.
Yeah.
And take advantage of the fact they're a bit starstruck. I mean, some of it actually really isn't a case of, oh God, well, he's asked me to sleep with him and I can't say no because he's such a big name. Some of it's worse than that, as in corralling people into corners and making out it's a joke, but it's really not because you're just not letting the person leave.
Yeah.
That sort of thing that's, you know, with 10-year-olds might kind of be school ground bullying, but you wouldn't tolerate it. And yet when it's adults, it's a really quite a dicey game.
Yeah.
And there's been various other things, you know, sort of, it's never okay to just reach out and grab some. But, I mean, if you're trying to pull them away from stepping out in front of a bus, maybe.
But, you know, I love the maybe. Maybe not. Well, why didn't you save them while I suspecting well, their boundaries?
In all fairness, if I'm falling over, I don't want someone to grab me because I can actually break my fall. Whereas if they grab my arm, they'll wrench my arm. So I tend to say, don't grab me, just let me fall. Unless it's off a cliff, in which case, I would rather you grabbed me.
You'll flip through the air and land elegantly on your feet, like all cats should.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, you know, it's not okay to just put your hand on a woman's knee or, you know, touch her breast or force her to hug you. Like, we shouldn't have to say this shit. We really should. Apparently we do have to say it. I was going to say, we're not going to go so far as to say you can't look, but, you know, if your version of looking is the 13-year-old boy gaze where you've just discovered that puberty's a thing and you're doing everything except sort of sticking your hand down your trousers, that's not cool, okay?
Yeah, especially not from an adult.
Especially not from an adult. I wouldn't go quite so far to the other end of the scale where, you know, everybody basically must be a sexless non-person to you either, because it's perfectly natural to think, oh, they look quite nice.
Yeah.
And then look away. You know, that's the thing, the looking away afterwards and not acting on it, not thinking, well, it's like a bar of chocolate, I fancy it, so I may as well have it.
Yeah, I may as well coerce them into a corner and then when they get freaked out, just say it was a joke. Ha ha. Because you have, there are three names on the list of people who've been sort of put out. And the other ones is the other one is James Dashner.
Yeah.
Who is the author of the Maze Runner. Have you read that, The Maze Runner?
I've read the first one.
Yeah. Now, it is interesting because these are two male authors who treat female characters in particular ways. James Dashner, in his book, there is only one female character.
Yeah, it's very much token. And the fact that I always found it really squicky that she's, like, thrown into a corral with 30 teenage boys.
Yeah.
And no adult supervision. Did nobody else think, okay, that's a bit rapey, even though there's no rape going on? And the fact that the first time they meet her, she wakes up and she's throwing stones to keep them away from her.
Yeah.
And also, I wasn't a big fan of The Maze Runner in the sense that it seemed a cynical attempt to put a main male character in place of Katniss Everdeen and cash in on the Hunger Games. That was my opinion of The Maze Runner, I'm afraid.
But yeah, we do have this treatment of female characters. Very different, and yet both, again, quite telling in some ways. Which is that we have this female character who is kind of just there to prop up, really. And she is just there as a sort of a fluff piece for the male character.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a, well, we must have a love interest, but I can't be bothered to write several different well-rounded female characters, so we'll just stick one in.
Yeah, we must have a love interest, but the gays aren't allowed.
Yeah, absolutely. God. And with
Sorry, it's just that many boys, at least a couple of them, have got to be queer, right?
Yeah, but we're not talking about it, because that wasn't in his vision.
So,
I could really get quite scathing about The Maze Runner. More scathing than I already have.
And then for 13 Reasons Why, it follows a female main character.
Who is already dead at the beginning of the book. It's almost, well, I suppose in a way he's taken the girl in the refrigerator and given her a voice, but it's not a great voice. It's very, she comes across as quite spiteful. It's not a good depiction of depression, in my opinion. And this is taking this from several different sources as well as personal experience. I'm not sure it's a great depiction of suicide. I did think it was quite a good depiction of rape culture, but now that I know what he's been up to, I'm kind of really grossed out, because there are two ways of doing your research. You can go out and talk to the people affected, or you can go out and affect people.
See, I honestly just think that he's blind to it.
I don't think he is. I think it's actually quite a cynical, he's well aware of what he's doing, and actually he quite enjoys the power play. I do agree there are people who are, like, oblivious to what they're doing, they don't realise how they come across.
Yeah.
I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? Because, okay, my low bar for someone for sexual harassment would be someone else's high bar, as in that would be really bad.
Yeah.
There are things that I would laugh off from certain people that I wouldn't laugh off from others. And, you know, there's a level of knowledge and understanding and how well you know somebody in there as well.
Yeah.
But it's not... I'm trying to think of the right way to put this, so I'm not being offensive, but... And I'm certainly not minimising anybody else's case, because if someone makes you feel uncomfortable and doesn't respond to you asking them to stop, or doesn't respond to you moving away, or doesn't respond to you displaying physical cues that you are uncomfortable and do not want that attention, then they are in the wrong, absolutely. I know for a fact with me that I would mouth off at somebody first, and I would start off jokey, and I would get progressively nastier. And I will go to the nth degree if I'm in a really bitchy mood, because I'm just that sort of person. And I wouldn't necessarily class that as me being victimised, because I'm well aware that I, if I decided to turn physical on them, that I could probably harm them. So I don't feel that the power's in their hands. But I suppose the thing is, if you're not like that, and you're not a real bitch when somebody like touches you, like I am, then maybe for you that would be a case of, okay, that's really uncomfortable, that's borderline sexual harassment, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
So there's no one level there. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, yeah. And I think you've made a very good point there. I mean, really it's about sort of control, isn't it?
Absolutely.
The loss of control in a situation. And I think that on one level, you know, I think it's possible that everyone has done something to someone, not necessarily sexual or anything like that, but everyone has done something to someone else, whether intentionally or not, where you have removed their control. And whether you then realized it at the time, whether they called you out on it or whether they didn't, it's something that everybody's done.
Yeah, absolutely.
The difference is the ability to understand that you have done it and then acting upon that ability again in order to get the results that you want. And that's when we get things like gaslighting. And if you think about it, saying, oh, it was all a joke, is a form of gaslighting.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I didn't mean anything by it. You know, why are you being so menstrual?
Yeah, exactly. It is a form of gaslighting because it's invalidating the memories that you have. All right, now again, I don't really want to be the person to do this, but I think it's possible that some of the people who have been listed who have committed these acts literally weren't doing it maliciously.
Yeah.
I think it's possible that, yeah, there have been a couple of people who maybe did get drunk on that power and acted out. That doesn't mean that it was right for them to do it. Not at all. And they should apologise and they should own up to it and they should, you know, take responsibility for what they did. But I think there's a very big difference between the kind of people who consciously commit that sort of offence and others who get caught up in the moment. Now, when it comes to, what's his face? James Dashner and Jay Asher. Have you realised how similar their names sound? I just assumed they were the same person, but like one wears a moustache, you know. And now I'm James Dashner, haha. You know, when it comes to them, the amount of harassment, you know, the amount of people who've come forward and said there has been a problem indicates that there really has been a problem, actually.
And the fact that
not
both
only that,
of them...
But it's been a problem which has been vocalised. They are conscious of it at this point in time.
Yeah, it's been reported and they've been warned and they've, you know, still been invited back, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, as you say, there's been no move to modify behaviour there.
Yeah, and they're getting away with it. They're literally getting away with it because they are such good sellers. And this is where the real issue within the industry stands out. Because just like with other big industries, they protect their money makers. And these are best sellers. These are people who draw in a big crowd because they are charming, because they have written things which have a great effect on people. Written things to the extent now that we have literally just had a bunch of Maze Runner movies coming out. We have had the Netflix series. You know, they are successful, and they're successful in the modern day. You know, that they're not disappearing artists. And so they can do what they want. And the industry is allowing them to do what they want. And we, as a public, are allowing them to do what they want because we tend to sort of put art first, which is wrong.
We put art first?
As in, we, you know, sorry, when I say we put art first, that's probably not quite right. I mean, we're putting their art first. We're putting their books first. We say, oh, we'll allow it because look at, you know, the things that they've created. You know, it's the same as with the abuse that actresses usually would get on set from famous directors. And it was just in the sake of art. So yeah, this woman was traumatized, but look at the movie, isn't it amazing?
Yeah. And, you know, that's obviously been going on for, well, years and years, ever since there's been a movie industry, and before that, presumably.
Yeah. Ever since there's been performance, ever since there has been art being sold for money, there has been abuses of power, and this is no exception. And the only way that this is going to stop is when people are held accountable for their actions. And they're just not being held accountable now.
I mean, having trolled through the school library's list and pretty much read every comment, I won't say that anybody was lying necessarily, but that list really attracted a few trolls as well.
Yeah.
And the trolls were fairly easy to see because they were either, you know, they were attacking both sides quite deliberately in order to do what trolls do, which is to get, you know, both sides of the argument stirred up against each other.
Yeah.
And one author, Mike Cole, who is a adult sci-fi writer, got named on the school library's list for some bizarre reason. But yeah, he didn't get named for sexual harassment or sexual assault, but he did get, you know, they did say, well, you know, he's overbearing and a misogynist. And he responded to that on Twitter with, I had no idea how I come across. It's basically the gist of what he said. And, you know, I'm really sorry. I've clearly made people feel uncomfortable. He's a big guy. He's, you know, he looks like he really works out. I expect he probably does. And he's tall. He's got a lot of presence in person, apparently. I've never met him. But he seems an all right guy. Now, to me, I wouldn't find him intimidating. And it's always a little bit of a mental flip for me to find that there are other people who find people like that intimidating.
Yeah.
So that's clearly my own personal purblindness, as in that's not the sort of person who I would find intimidating. But I do get it. I can kind of see that someone else who did not feel capable of looking after themselves or didn't, you know, doesn't have mouthiness as a default setting, might genuinely feel really uncomfortable. And if someone like that hits on you and you're feeling really, really uncomfortable,
yeah,
then it probably does cross the line into that's kind of harassment for you, particularly if they're kind of, they won't take no for an answer. And he seems like one of those confident, charismatic people who likes to turn no's into yeses, not in a rapey way, just in a kind of, are you sure you mean to say no kind of way?
Yeah, in that I'm not giving up so easily. But I think another thing that we should probably mention is racial profiling.
Yeah.
Now, this is, you know, part of a much bigger problem, and not just racial profiling, but I mean profiling in general, which is that, especially when it comes to young black men in the Western world, the media and the way that, you know, we've been trained, you know, the internal sort of racism and sort of the racist undertones of with which we grew up has meant that there is this profile of young black men as criminals, which is totally unfair. But we also see them as people who are stronger, people who are violent, people who are more likely to, I don't know. But this is the profile that exists. And we see it all the time where we see, you know, images of gang violence, and they always cast black men in films, and the black men in films are always highly sexualized, or you know, very sexual beings, always saying very, very provocative kind of things. And this is the image which is ingrained into us from a very young age, which means that you then get a young woman who meets a very big black man, and he hits on her in a totally friendly and natural way. You know, maybe he sort of offers her for a drink, and she's intimidated. And so she then calls him out and says, "Oh, he was harassing me." And so a part of it, and this is the same then for authors and creators who are part of the LGBT community as well, you know, the queer community, in that, we sort of tend to think we can think of sort of homosexual, I mean, the joke is always at school, you know, be careful of homosexuals in school, they'll just jump on you in the locker, like, no.
They'll turn you gay.
They'll turn you gay. Exactly. Yeah. Like, all I remember being in the school, in the girls' locker room, was that I didn't want anyone to see me, so I would just hide.
Like, see,
none of us were looking at each other, none of us wanted to see each other, we just wanted to get the whole ordeal of getting in and out of our clothes done as quickly as possible.
Yeah, see, my memory of changing in the girls' changing room, obviously slightly different to yours, since mine was an all-girls school, and we had... But our PE teacher is kind of like, if you can't get dressed in 2 minutes, you may as well not bother kind of thing. She used to stand there and time us. There was no time for anything else.
I don't have time to ogle. I must remove my bra. Yeah, exactly. So, you know,
sidebar there.
So profiling does need to come into it. And I think that we need to, and this is the difficult bit, because, you know, we talk about gaslighting, and I think it is possible to gaslight yourself. But you also do need to examine what was the behavior. Look at it from, you know, a very analytical point of view. What was the behavior? Why did it make me uncomfortable? And particularly sort of specify why, because I think that there is a possibility that there are people out there who are being accused of harassment, who would not have those same accusations, would have been seen as friendly, would have been seen as welcoming, a little bit flirty, if they did not fit a certain profile.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And of course, the big double-edged sword with harassment of any kind is the fact that if it's somebody you don't want, then potentially it's harassment. But if it's somebody you might be interested in, quite often it's not.
Exactly.
Now, which is a terrible thing to say, because that sounds like it's just like harassment is just a way of getting rid of somebody that you're not interested in, or, you know, you don't find them sexually attractive. It's obviously a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah. And this is the problem, is that, you know, we want to support people who are coming forward and talking about harassment. We want to, you know, make sure that they feel safe, that they feel validated. But we do actually have to look at the other side of it and look at sort of profiling, racism, you know, homophobia, And also just bigotry in general. We have to consider these things as well. And it is difficult because there is no one line. All we can say for sure is that harassment is wrong. And if you are being put in a situation in which you feel uncomfortable, and this person is persisting despite attempts, then, you know, that's just not right at all. It isn't right. You should not be put into positions where you feel uncomfortable. But, you know, I think there are people who, however innocently, will accidentally make people feel uncomfortable, even if it wasn't their intention. The importance is that they back off if it's obvious that actually, no, this isn't what this person wants. The consent isn't there. And they back off and they immediately, you know, desist. That's where the line is, really. Now, I wanted to talk about, because we've been talking about male harassers and abusers. There was on the list a woman in particular, Tristina Wright.
Yes, I read her book.
So you've read her book. So tell me a little bit about Tristina Wright.
I don't know an awful lot about her, but the reason I kind of ended up reading 27 Hours, and I mentioned it on a previous podcast, actually, because I don't like it. I think it's tokenism, not diversity, but I do believe her intentions were genuine.
Mm.
Is the fact that every single character has multiple, belongs to multiple minorities, if you like, is the quickest way of saying it. And she's tried to represent everything, and she hasn't worried about plot and character and all the things you really need to make a book work, in my opinion. But part of the problem was that very early editions of the book, where they were going to the advanced readers, so one reader gave it a lukewarm review, and the author hunted her down on Twitter and started bombarding her with abuse, and reported her to Goodreads to get her review taken down. Which they wouldn't do because there wasn't anything wrong with the review, it was just her opinion. So she downgraded her rating right down to one star at the very beginning. So already the author was at a stage where basically she was coming in as an author behaving badly, because it's never ever a good idea to troll somebody who's read your book and doesn't like it.
Yeah.
I mean, that should be obvious to everybody, but just in case it's not... the worst thing was that she and several authors like her, Justina Ireland's another one, L.L. McKinney is another, called up, you know, they released the Kraken with their Twitterati, their Twitter followers, and got them to start spamming people as well. These are the same people who called out the book The Black Witch by Laurie Forrest, which actually isn't racist at all. Or ableist, or any of the other things levelled at it, without having reading it, and asked them to go to Goodreads and one star the book. So this is all part of a much, much bigger issue. So already we're starting from a position of, if nothing else, she's reckless and a bit misguided and doesn't really listen to the other side of the equation, in my opinion.
Apparently, she was... a victim of abuse herself, and she's been flagged as having been abused, and her response was that no, you know, I was an abuse victim myself, so I can't be an abuser, which is troubling, really, because. Absolutely, people who have been abused can still abuse others. It doesn't excuse you. Just like being part of one minority doesn't mean that you can't be racist or homophobic or anything like that. You know, that being part or having been repressed in some way does not mean that you yourself become totally guiltless of everything. And it's something which can be hidden behind, really, and the inability to accept criticism, which we've seen from her so far, suggests that there is a truth to what is being said about her. Because she won't own up to it. And she does have this rather bad history of getting quite close to some of her readers, of gaslighting, of using her fame to get the results that she wants from her followers and things like that. And that, to me, shows someone who is abusing their power, really.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. And to be honest, I can't speak for the sexual harassment claims. I wouldn't necessarily, you know, I'm not disbelieving anybody. The only thing that gives me pause is the specific occasion where it was supposed to have happened. She actually wasn't present.
Well, that's the thing, is that that was with one, but apparently several have come forward.
If more have come forward since it, to be fair, I haven't read anything on that thread for a week, so I'm not completely 100% up to date now.
No, I haven't either. So I'm just saying what's been reported. I'm definitely not telling our listeners to go ahead and you know, blacklist her or to send her abusive messages or anything like that. But this is what has been reported. And I felt like it was important to mention her because, you know, we do need to look at the fact that there are people, that there are women who are just as guilty of this as men within the industry. And not only that, but there are people who can hide behind the fact, you know, she's openly bisexual, so she's part of a minority. She was abused apparently in her past and has come forward and spoken about that. There are people who fit within that, who fit within a demographic which one could call victim, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. You know,
she fits within a victim demographic and yet is just, and yet the claims that people have made against her need to be examined with the same cold clarity as everybody else.
Yeah, definitely. And there is definitely a history of online bullying there.
Yeah.
So that's not a great starting point. She shouldn't have weighed in on that. No thread, really, anyway. Full stop.
No. It's a difficult one. And the other side is that there are people, you know, it has been suggested that there may be people who are weighing in on her, sort of saying she's been sexually harassing people as part of an attack against her rather than because it actually genuinely happened. This is also an excellent way to, you know, have authors you don't like who perhaps stand for things that you don't, to bring them down, to sort of destroy their reputation, because nothing will, I say nothing will destroy a person's reputation more than sexual harassment, but as the industry has shown, actually, abuse and sexual harassment will literally do nothing if you are famous enough.
No, I think perhaps that's a point where we should just talk about the generalized sexism in the writing publishing industry, because for an industry where in general most of the people, certainly in the mid-level jobs, most of the agents, most of the editors, and they tend to be female generally, but what's really interesting is if you look at writing and what gets published in its own right, the Guardian recently published results of a survey. Okay, between 1850 and 1950, the number of women being published dropped from 50% of the overall market to 30%.
It's unbelievable.
we were better represented, and it's even better than that. After 1950, only a third of all the characters in all the books published since then, only a third of them have been female. There is a high resistance among male authors to write female characters.
Yeah.
Or to include more than to make more than just one third of their characters female, if at all. Which is really interesting. We were better represented as both characters in fiction and by writers, although admittedly probably some of them are writing under pseudonyms, in 1850.
That is terrifying.
Now, part of the fact that in 1850, you probably would only be writing a book if you were relatively educated.
Yeah.
If you could read and write for a start, you'd have been handwriting the book. So yeah. No laptops or anything. In terms of how many people were educated, the chances are that there would have been, it's a class thing. So people from the lower divides would not have been able to do it. So yeah. some, in order to, a simple supply and demand equation, you would need to accept some books from female authors. You just had to, because otherwise you just wouldn't have had anything to publish. So we have to weigh that in the balance.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily that they were more enlightened about, you know, gender and everything. Let's remember when the Women's Property Act came into force. That's still really appalling. Since 1950, we've actually been less represented.
And it's also that when women writers do come forward, there is this limited idea, until fairly recently, that women write books for women and men write books for men and women.
Yeah, there is very much that idea.
And, you know, someone just made the argument, said, oh, but all these women were writing crime fiction. And, like, you know, I had to point out that Poirot, Agatha Christie and stuff like that is mainly read by women, actually.
To be fair, 70% of the entire book reading market is women.
Yeah. But it's a bit crazy, you know, to the point that J.K. Rowling, and I hate to keep talking about her, but she's just an excellent example for lots of things, uses her initials.
Yeah.
Because, and I use my initials when I'm writing. You use your initials.
I do.
When you're writing. Because it just makes it you're a tiny bit more likely for you to be picked up off the shelf. And we're moving, I think, away from that a little bit more now, because we have a lot more prominent female writers coming forward in YA specifically and within children's books too. But that stigma does sort of remain still, that as we're coming into an era where the author needs to be as sellable as the book, men remain more sellable than women.
Yeah. Here's another equation for you. If at a conservative estimate, 70% of 70% of readers are female.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if 70% of readers are female and only 30% of writers are female, that means that the other 70%, you know, are male by default.
Yeah.
We're not talking gender here. We're just talking biological sex, if you like.
Well, yeah. We're just
without opening that can of worms.
Yeah. Let's not open that can of worms. Let's just yeah.
So 70% of books tell you not what to think necessarily, but they tell you how to think. But they also can tell you how to think about yourself. So you've got 70% of the 70% of readers, female, reading books, of which 70% of those are written by men, who will only include up to one third of their characters as female. So all these readers, all these women, are seeing themselves A, underrepresented, and B, badly represented in fiction, or represented in a way that makes them A, sexy lamps, girls in refrigerators,
mm-hmm.
Walk-on parts, someone who is literally just there to be the love interest.
Yeah.
They're seeing themselves portrayed as incompetent and weaker and more persuadable and more amenable. All these things, it's reinforcing everything that we are conditioned to believe about ourselves from the time we're born, basically, yeah, as females.
And this actually ultimately affects the way that we write as well. You yeah. know, the first few books, and still even to this day, I struggle to write books with main female leads because I literally have to train myself to stop thinking of women as boring. You know, I would always have my characters as male because I always found writing female characters boring. And then I suddenly went, why? I've got lots of friends. Yeah, I've said this before. I'm probably just repeating myself, but I have lots of friends who are girls. I don't think of them as boring. I don't think of myself as boring. But because of the way that women are characterized within these, within the media, I would always think of that women, female characters just had to be that way. And that meant that I could never appreciate them. I never liked them because they weren't me and they didn't really represent anything that was to do with me. And that was very, very damaging, and it continues to be damaging, and it continues to influence female writers to this day, which just perpetuates. And you know, we talked about the gender thing as well, and the sexism persists, because if we do have, you know, 30% women and sort of, you know, around 70% of male writers, that's even worse if you have non-binary. I mean, how many non-binary writers can you name, Jules?
I can't off the top of my head,
yeah,
genuinely.
I might
be able to name a couple of trans writers, but not non-binary.
Yeah, I can name a sort of a couple of trans writers. And being a trans woman and being a trans man, it's going to be a different experience.
Yeah.
It's going to be a different experience. And so the representation of gender and the representation, you know, the sexism that we get in the industry, which means that at the moment, you know, I go through the MS, WL hashtag, the manuscript wish list. The manuscript wish list. Try saying that really fast. It's really difficult. I've been going through that for Twitter, and I just keep seeing all these things saying, please, we want, you know, we want own voices. We want, you know, diversity. And all these agents and all these publishers saying, oh yeah, we want diversity. And I'm like, this is great. This is great. But where are the books? Yeah. Where are they? I'm not seeing them on the shelves. Well, I am. I'm seeing them very, very slowly. But it's still an excruciatingly slow process, to the point where people say we want diversity, but they're still very limited by what they think is sellable, to the point that they're stuck with a format that they know, and so they can't take a chance on something which is very new.
Yeah.
Which means that we get a lot of where we find the representation of trans authors and where we find sort of more diverse casts tends to be within independent and self-published authors instead, because no one will take the chance on them.
Yeah, but they feel very strongly, or rather we feel very strongly about these things, so put them in the books anyway.
Exactly. You know, talking about disability and things like that. It's a hard one, because at the end of the day, we have to remember that it is a business. And they do, that this is a business that is trying to turn out money, and agents have to sort of know things are sellable, and it's hard to know what's going to sell and what isn't going to sell. So, you know, you can't sort of say, oh, agents, you're all, you know, people of the devil or anything like that. I mean, I don't know. I've not spoken to anyone who's recently called an agent a person of the devil. But, you know, we can't sort of blame them for something which is sort of widely spread. And I think the only way that this is going to be improved, the sexism with the industry, the claims of sexual harassment, is if we come forward as a community and just start saying no. And if we come forward as a community and start showing that sexism no longer sells.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I would add, there's a couple of things I would add. One is that I do know some male authors who genuinely don't feel comfortable writing female main characters. And I can kind of see that, because we have a very strident contingent on the left saying, stay in your lane.
Mm.
Now, I think you should be able to write whatever you want, really. I don't know if you necessarily need to keep adding more male characters without a balance of female characters in your cast to the problem, but that's up to you. Ultimately, I wouldn't feel, I'd be quite happy to write a black or an Asian or whatever main character, but I would feel very uncomfortable trying to portray the black struggle, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not really my story to tell. So, you know, there is a balance there. It's a case of don't appropriate stories which aren't really yours to tell, but absolutely include a diverse cast. And ignore the people who say stay in your lane on that. As long as you're doing your due diligence, I don't see there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah.
So the same for male writers. If you want to write a female main character, you have at it. You know, go and talk to some women. You'll soon find we don't think that differently.
No.
Our life experiences might be slightly different. But, I mean, some of the best female characters I've read are actually written by male authors, and I'm quite happy to say that.
And some of the best male characters I've ever read are written by female authors.
Absolutely.
It's almost like we're all the same species.
It is, isn't it? It's funny that.
But yeah.
And going back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, you feeling female characters were boring. In a lot of the books I grew up with, the female characters were boring. You know, they were cardboard. And I still get now a sort of opposite reaction in the sense of I'm thinking, oh God, I'm writing another female main character. Everyone's going to be so fed up. My writing's so cliche. And then you check the figures and you realise how few female main characters there really are. It's like, no, no, you're good. You're good. You don't have to write a main character just for the sake of balance here. So that's where I am.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, I'm writing 5 books at the moment. And only two of them have a female main character. I'm pretty bad. anyway,
but going back to the saying, and I will draw to a close in a moment, obviously, but going back to the saying no to sexism, absolutely, say no to sexism. There is, and this is a point that it's a case of take it away and chew it over kind of thing, anyone who's listening, and that is those of us who have been discriminated against or oppressed or sexually harassed are completely entitled to our own personal anger. We really are.
Yes.
And that's fine. But if you want to change the system that allowed those things to happen, then your personal anger doesn't have a place in it. Your personal anger is for you and your friends and those who are close to you, people you trust. It is not for changing the system. And the reason I'm saying is I see a lot of people who jump on these threads that start off in a really good place of openness and getting people to talk and become attacks on the very people that we want to educate and bring into the fold and embrace. And that's not how you do it. It's very much the same thing as during the end of apartheid. Nelson Mandela said that those who are enriched and propped up by a corrupt system are actually its victims as much as its perceivable victims are. And the only way to go forward is for everybody to say what they've done and then for there to be, you know, for everybody then to come together afterwards. That there shouldn't be punishment or atonement as such. There should be honesty and acceptance and moving forward. And I genuinely believe that applies to sexism and to Me Too and sexual harassment and all these things that just keep coming out of the woodwork that really can make you feel quite depressed and quite low. So your own personal anger is definitely yours and you should own it and you shouldn't be silent about it if you don't want to be. But it's not a weapon and it's not a tool for change. So bear it in mind. Here endeth the sermon.
It's an interesting point. It's also a difficult one to hear. And I don't know whether I agree with it or not, but then a part of me that says, is it that I don't agree with it because I'm angry? So I think you're right. I think it's something that needs to be chewed over. And I think it definitely has. You've made a very salient point.
I will say that if someone had said those words to me 10 years ago, I would have, well, if I'd said that to me 10 years ago, I'd have smacked myself in the face. So I completely understand it. And you have to be at the point where...
Wait, am I you 10 years in the past?
I don't think so. No, I'd still be older than you. For a start. But no, it's difficult, isn't it? And that's why I'm making the point that, you know, you're entitled to your anger. You're entitled to how you feel about it. And you shouldn't ever have to be silent about any of those things.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tough one.
But yeah. It is a tough one. But anyway, as I said, I'm not saying that I'm right. I'm saying take it away and chew it over. And if you really think I'm wrong, you can find me on Twitter. It's fine.
Well, I think that we've actually managed to pound that topic. That's a terrible way of putting it.
That is a really bad way.
I was going to sort of pound it into the ground, but it just sounds like we were...
Like you're putting up a tent.
Yeah, sure. Let's go with that euphemism then. yeah, I think we've managed to wrangle everything out of that subject that we currently can at the moment. We'd be really interested to hear your thoughts. And if you feel up to it, sharing any experiences that you yourself have had or experiences that you've heard of, please do get in contact with us. Remember, you can find us on Facebook, or you can also follow us on Twitter. And now for our recommendation of the week. This one is coming from both Jules and I, so I'll let Jules announce it.
Oh, right. Well, if you haven't been to see the new Marvel film Black Panther, get your ass down to the cinema. It's really, really good. It has so many good things about it, and I'm sure we'll go into it more in another episode. Obviously, there's the diverse cast. It's a black superhero movie, which is wonderful.
It is.
And the representation, after that really long, difficult podcast about sexism, the portrayal of female characters in that is the best I've seen in the Marvel universe or the superhero universe, bar Wonder Woman, I think.
It is, because it's literally the main cast is Black Panther and three women.
Yeah.
I love it. It's fantastic. The music is brilliant. The scenery, the visual effects, the dialogue. I just fell in love with it as a movie. I had no idea what to expect when I was going in. And I honestly do think it's one of the top ones that Marvel has produced so far. And in terms of seeing female representation, and not just female representation, but female representation of women of color, of black women, it's just spectacular. So highly recommended. Someone made a point. This is a terrible joke, but there are only two white there are only two white guys in the film, really. And so I guess you could say that they're the Tolkien white guys.
Oh, that's so bad. That's painfully, painfully bad. Oh,
what? Gollum and Bilbo Baggins. Sorry. Yeah, that wasn't my joke. I just saw it as a terrible pun. And as you know, the only way that you can cure yourself from a terrible pun is to share it. So on that note, we will catch you guys next week. And until then, bye bye.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.